Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Eliza Kristen. We'll talk to Eliza about Lilia, Missy. Is it Missy or Meezy?
Missy.
The pandemic, and of course, we'll get into some wine. We'll taste a Vino Bianco from Cortona for a weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born in Taipei, Taiwan, Eliza Kristen and family made their way to the United States. Eliza attended the University of Illinois and found her love for hospitality and wine in culinary mecca, Champaign-Urbana. She traveled the world to work harvests in Italy, Australia, and Oregon, and is studying for her wine certifications. We'll see if she still is. Eliza worked at the Meadowood Resort out in Napa, Momofuku Co., before meeting Sean Feeney of Grove House. Eliza Kristen is now the beverage director of Chef Missy Robbins and Sean Feeney's Lilia and Missy in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you for Eliza. Having me, Sam.
So, a couple of cool things. We're back in the Heritage Radio Network studios for the first time in easily over a year and a half. So that's fun. That's the first thing. The second thing is you're my first guest.
Wow.
Back in the studio. So it's nice to have you here.
It's an honor.
And I'll remember coming back the day, but I'll also remember that it was you, or more importantly, that it was you. And, you know, hopefully we'll be back in the studio, you know, a lot more. So that's kind of fun. All right. So let's get right into it because you and I have a lot to talk about. We probably won't even cover it all. In doing some research and, you know, talking to people about you and all that, you have a great story. So like all my other guests, to give them a little context, give me some background about your journey in life and wine that got you, you know, to where you are today, which is, you know, running the beverage program at arguably, you know, two of the more renowned restaurants in New York and the country.
Sure. So growing up in Taipei, my family went out to eat a lot and we were always in restaurants, and that was kind of the extent of my childhood restaurant connection. I didn't work in my, you know, parents'
right.
family restaurant or anything like that. I just was a frequent patron growing up. My parents to this day are still very passionate about eating out. They're actually going to be in New York soon, and I can't wait to take them to a whole list of restaurants. And then I... go right ahead.
One of my biggest knocks is I interrupt my guests. But they're coming here and you want to take them to... But what's like... I should ask you this, but what's the one place you want to or have to bring them to?
They love the Four Horsemen.
Okay.
That's
a cool answer.
Yeah.
All right. So leave it at that because sure. We'll get to another. All right. So continue.
Yes.
If you remember where we were.
For sure. So I was in college at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. I went into college a little lost and confused about where I wanted to end up in life. And you know, some kids have the fortune and the foresight to really know where they want to be and what direction they want to go in. And I was not one of those kids. So during college, I went to college for psychology and ended up also adding on art history because I took a class and fell in love with it. You'll notice a pattern here. But during college, I started to work at several local restaurants in Champaign. And really kind of fell in love with restaurant life.
Was that initially more about I need a job? Or was there any thought like this could be a cool thing to do or a little of both?
It was I need a job and it was to occupy my time a little bit and it was to maybe force some kind of direction, just to put myself on a path in one way or another. I was nearing graduation. I think it was my junior year of college and I was no clearer about where I wanted to be. And so I really dove into the restaurant thing because I loved it. And I was really lucky to find that path and kind of stumble upon it. And
so you got engaged by the industry.
I did.
I mean, you didn't mind doing it, the hospitality
thing. No.
So you work in a few cool places.
Yeah.
In Champaign, Urbana, right? So mm-hmm. What happens? Take me further along.
So while I was there, while I was working at a restaurant named Bacro, that is no longer there, but
was that fine dining for Champaign Urbana?
It was fine dining, period.
Okay.
In a similar way that like Lily and Missy is, you know, there are service standards. It's comfortable. It's
right.
It's you. There's no dress code. It's not
per se or
no, you know, no.
But the everything else is right there.
Yeah, but there's you know thought that goes into every single part of a guest meal, and right. That to me is headed towards fine dining.
And you noticed and recognized
yeah.
that they had that attention.
Yeah, the attention to detail was one of the first things that kind of blew me away about the restaurant. And the wine program was incredible. The chef owner was also into wine, and he was the one who bought the wine for the restaurant and was so generous with sharing it and getting all the staff excited about it, front and back of house. That's what ultimately set me on my wine path.
So that guy was an important guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
He had the right plate, good wine program, good food, good mm-hmm. attention. All right, so do you eventually graduate and leave town?
I never graduated.
You don't have a college degree?
I did not.
Okay, we're going to have to end the interview.
I'll see you later.
No. All right, so you don't finish.
Yeah.
You just decide it's a waste of time to be in college?
Yeah, I was in my senior year. I had finished all of the accreditation for both psychology and art history, and I was left looking at the course book and being like, what do I do for the last semester? Take ice skating? Like, I didn't really know what to, like, I just had credits that I needed to fill to graduate. And at that point I was like, I'm really loving the restaurant industry. And
so you just bailed.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. My parents are still a little, not pleased with me about it, but they've.
So you hang out in Illinois a little?
I do.
How long and then where do you go?
Actually, working at the restaurant allowed me, they were incredible and flexible with their time and allowed me to work my first couple harvests. And I was doing them back to back. So I was going Northern Hemisphere in Italy. And then 4 or 5 months later, I was in Australia working another harvest. So, and I was allowed to leave for, you know, a month, month and a half, 2 months at a time.
What's the name of the place? Bacaro?
Bacaro, B-A-C-A-R-O.
And these guys got you involved in the harvest and let you go?
Yeah. The
That's amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I started studying wine before I went to harvest and I realized that I needed some context, which, you know, there's not a lot of wine context in Champaign, Illinois, but really anywhere without being on the ground and being in the vineyard and talking to the winemakers, which we, you know, being in New York, you have much more access to,
right.
But
right.
you don't in the middle of the country. And so I took it upon myself and went on a big trip on my own.
So when do you decide and how do you get out of there and where do you go?
So my very first harvest was at Tenuta di Valgiano, which is a winery outside of Lucca in Tuscany. And we served the wines at the restaurant, and I loved the wines. Everyone was super excited about the wines. And I had met the one of the owners when they came and did a tasting in Chicago. And they, because the restaurant was such a big supporter of theirs, they would come down to Champaign, Illinois from Chicago.
Right.
And we would do a dinner for them and all that. So I, you know, was put in touch with him, and we sorted everything out, and I went.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So then keep going.
And then, you know, that very first trip was a 2 month long trip. I stayed well after harvest, and almost didn't come back.
It was kind of cool.
Totally enamored with, that lifestyle and, in Italy, period.
All right. So you do come back. Where do you come to?
I come back. I'm working at the restaurant again.
Okay. Get me out of the Midwest already, will you?
I know. So then I go to Australia, and that's a whole other...
Another harvest.
A whole other harvest, doing all that. And then my partner at the time moved to New York to take a job, and that's what kind of brought me here a couple months after he came here. And and then I landed in New York on 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street.
What year was that?
You have the facts in front of you.
Ballpark.
I don't know. 2017,
16 or 17.
17, something like that. Yeah.
So where do you work in New York?
I landed in an apartment in the East Village on 2nd Ave and 2nd.
I like that neighborhood.
Street. Yeah, it was pretty in place.
Funky.
Yeah, it was an intense place to land. Moofuku Co. was around the corner, and I...
Looked
them up, and I thought that they were
awesome.
So
that wasn't like a connection or a record. That was a proximity, like, let me give it a shot.
Exactly. It was a cold call.
That's great. So do you go in just as a server or?
I mean, I went in. At that point, I had taken a couple of the exams, and I told them that I was on this path, and I wanted to continue to work with wine. They, rightfully so, were like, we're not quite sure about your experience, and we need you to kind of work through the positions of the restaurant first and understand the restaurant and understand New York.
Thing.
Absolutely. It was so valuable.
Was anybody there then that's around now?
The GM is still there, yeah. Suwon Ruiz.
Any of the wine people?
So when I started, Jordan was there,
okay.
Jordan Salcito.
Right.
Chase Senzer was also there.
Those guys are still around.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how long do you spend at Momofuku? So you do go through the...
I do.
The whole deal
from,
you know, wine, service.
You know,
how much time do you spend there?
I was, you know, the classic impatient kid and was like, you promised I could work as a sommelier. When is this going to happen? And, you know, was really pushing hard for it. And I finally got there, a couple months, I don't know, I'm sorry, Sue, I don't remember, 5-6 months into it.
Wow, that's pretty quick.
And then I ended up staying for, a year and a half, almost two.
So was that you became a sommelier, or they made you a sommelier?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that was your first really wine-centric job.
I mean,
I'm just dealing with wine and
for
all
For sure.
Okay. So you do that for a year and a half. What happens? Get antsy, you got to grow, an offer comes up?
It was a fantastic learning experience in so many ways, professionally, but also personal for me. And I had kind of, I wanted to work harvest again. I wanted to get back on the ground and you know, it's kind of a shock to go, of course, from Champaign, Illinois to New York, and especially a restaurant like Co., which, you know, people are spending big bucks there and they're buying kind of once-in-a-lifetime wines on a nightly basis. And I felt like I didn't want to go down the road where I was, like, feeling like I was kind of wheeling and dealing a little bit and feeling like I was
So you didn't love that vibe.
Merchandise.
That vibe.
You know, I
mean, it was kind of a cool place, but when you analyzed what was going on, you were almost there, but that wasn't exactly it.
I felt like I was losing the connection to, you know, the reason why I fell in love with wine in the first place. And again, I was tasting incredible things on a nightly basis, people, you know, stuff that people don't get to taste.
In New York, especially.
In New York, especially. Yeah. And I wouldn't take that back for a second. But I felt like I needed to do more, see more. And I had planned a whole, like, several month Euro trip, pretty much, starting with another harvest in Italy with my friends at Valgiano again. And then working my way down. So I started in Copenhagen after that and traveled and, wow, and really bounced around for 3-4 months.
Right.
Yeah.
So just so I get it right, you leave Momofuku to go to Europe to work.
Yeah.
You spend the time there and then you come back.
Yeah. So I came back. I wasn't sure that I wanted to come back to New York.
Right. Cause you didn't land in it. So what happened?
Well, so my partner and I decided that we wanted to give California a go. I felt like
for wine reasons for California reasons.
Wine reasons for me. Okay. And my partner's a chef and it was food for him.
Okay.
Just the produce that you have at your disposal there is incredible.
Cool place. It's good. Mixture.
Exactly.
There's good produce in Iowa, but not great wine. Yeah, so it makes sense.
Yeah. For sure. And I felt like I wanted to deep dive in Californian wine a little bit. So we ended up in Napa. And that's when Meadowood happened for me.
How does the Meadowood thing come up? Because that's top of the game for that area.
It was another cold call.
And, it was?
Yeah. And I...
God.
Yeah, and I interview well. I don't know. Maybe I.
No. I was just gonna say it's obviously more than you know your credentials.
Yeah.
You obviously, you know, captivate people.
Yeah.
So you're out there. You're doing Meadowood. Who was the chef there? Was that
Costow?
Chris Costow.
It's still
right?
Chris Costow. Yeah. Yeah.
Place burnt down, right?
Yeah. They've been doing pop ups, but I think they're
rebuilding.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yeah.
So you had a great. You were in a great place with a great wine program with, you know, one of the terrific chefs.
Yeah.
So you stay there how long?
So I stay there. I think we landed in February. And then come May, my partner was having some, you know, he was still very, we met at Momofuku Co. And he was still very connected to Momofuku in general. And an opportunity came up for him. So
To
bring him back. And serendipitously, we were just talking about what we were going to do and have a cross-country, long-distance relationship. We weren't sure what was going to happen. And Sean Feeney reached out out of the complete blue and sent me an email.
How do you think Sean got your name?
When I was at Co, he came in.
Okay. So you made a... Yeah, I think I read that.
Yeah, a friend of his... who I, you know, would see on a semi-regular basis.
So again, you lit him up.
Yeah.
Right? So he reaches out.
Yeah.
So that's, you're in New York, not that long.
Mm-hmm. In California, not that long, yeah.
California, you didn't even do a year.
Yeah,
not
no.
Not even 3/4 of a
no.
year.
Mm-mm.
You come back, you bump into Sean, he offers you a job.
He reached out to me when I was still in Napa.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and he was like, we're about to open.
I told you this was a good story.
We're about to open a second restaurant. We would love you to be the beverage director of both Lilia and Missy.
Who was doing it? Like, who launched it and who was there before?
Doing Lilia, the beverage program?
Beverage.
David Sawyer was the wine director before me at Lilia. And they were about to open Missy. And they reached out to me and I took over.
See, that hiring you is zero risk. But it still seems like, you know... You know, who's Eliza? I mean, she's got great credentials and she's great, but...
I ask myself that all the time.
No. I mean, it was a stellar, you know, move and all that. And
yeah.
It bared itself out.
Yeah.
All right. So you get to Missy, Lilia. They bring you in, hitting the ground running the program. You don't have to claw your way up to anything there.
No.
So you got a bunch of somms working for you in each place?
Not immediately, no. Lilia never had somms because it was just one restaurant.
Right.
I believe David was there all the time.
Right.
And I joined the team in May, and then they were planning on opening Missy in August, September. So I had the summer to kind of, you know, familiarize myself with the people, the culture, and really get in there at Lilia. And it became obvious very quickly that if I were to spend my time between two restaurants, I would need help and I would need support. And
that's where you got the help.
Exactly.
did you have the heavy hand, and we'll talk about it specifically a little later, in developing and designing the Missy wine list?
Yeah, right?
I mean, that's your list. Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
I want to talk about that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. All right, so we're current. Took a little bit to get there, but I think it was worth.
Long-winded.
Not saying that. No, that was me. I wanted to get every detail right.
Yeah.
All right. I want to talk about something that's, you know, almost hard to avoid for what I'm doing, and certainly for what you're doing. You know, I think you've been at Lilly and Missy, over three years or whatever. And I think you and I would agree that the first wave of COVID was fairly devastating.
Yeah.
And we're still living in it, but not at the point where everything is, you know, shut down.
Yeah.
All of this that I ask you, I want your take and opinion on it. Are we out of the woods in your mind? Are we worried about these new variants? Is there still a cloud, you know, over the industry? I mean, I don't think there's a reason to breathe any sigh of relief, but tell me where, you know, you're at.
I mean, I'm by no means an expert.
I'm not asking you to be. You know, tell me what you think and feel.
I think that is something that I have definitely learned in this last year, is a sense of humility and kind of a drop in the ocean type mentality of taking what comes and just doing the best that we can to react to it. And it's hard to say what's right around the corner. But, you know, we, in the last year, spent a lot of time checking in with staff, and reopening was really difficult. Just, you know, because of all the new procedures we had to put in place, build and then put in place, but also because everyone had such a hard year, and it, you know, crazy. Staff and ourselves, and it really was, you know, a new part of my job came forward.
You had to play that sort of.
For sure.
Part of, you know, what was going on in the restaurant.
Yeah. But offering the support to you know, our employees and to the management team and to the owners and to each other, and really being there for each other.
And everybody got through it. I mean, a lot of restaurants didn't make it.
Yeah.
Or made it in a different form.
Yep.
You know, fortunately, you guys are run by smart people.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say deep pockets, but it was successful going into it. Some people were, you know, struggling, but that's not what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah.
So when you look forward, what are you feeling? I mean, are we still in a very tentative situation, or what's?
I mean, I think that's what all restaurants are kind of balancing, is that there was financial support over the last year from, you know, the government, but it's still, there's kind of a oh God, like this is our moment to be open and do all the business we can, and like balancing that with the emotional easing into it that everyone has to do. And it's just, it's ongoing.
You know, when you talk about the emotional part, you know, you're talking about people.
Yeah.
And I think the pandemic illuminated a lot of inequities in the industry. I mean, I've done a year's worth of shows, not successively or every show, but about what was going on at the times. I mean, there was inequities with salary, work conditions. It's definitely discrimination, sexual harassment, you know, rose to the top. Do you think that, like, pre-pandemic, it was obviously going on and the industry was not good at addressing it? Like, it sort of pushed it aside?
I think there was a lot of, you know, in the same way that I was charmed by the restaurant industry when I first started out, there's a lot of, you know, it's the avenue through which people go out and enjoy themselves as guests and as people on the other side of that serving them. You know, there's a lot of kind of bright lights and flashy things that you can totally get sucked into that, you know, seem much more important. And I think that all of that being stripped away in the last year doesn't leave much makeup for, you know, and cover up for all of these other things that have been there all along.
Yeah. I think the fact that they've come to light and some of them are being addressed is nice, but Not that I don't have faith, but I think it's going to take time.
Yeah.
You know, and hopefully everybody, you know, realizes, you know, we live in a different world.
Yeah.
You know, when you say, it's like you're in the business because you get juice to get in there and you like the action. And, you know, most people, when they go to a place like Lily, it's like, you know, they're geared up for like, this is one of the best meals I'm going to have.
Yeah.
I'm curious, has the customer been behaving? I mean, do they?
Yeah. I mean,
New York's a pretty buy-in place. Like, here's what we have to do. But you see stories with airlines, people fighting. I mean,
are people
defiant about masks or rude to, I mean.
It was definitely, I think for the most part last summer, I'm remembering the first month that we were open in July. It was awkward, frankly. And it was awkward for staff. It was awkward for guests. And I think there was a little bit of camaraderie in the awkwardness.
It was more not knowing.
Yeah.
And than just people being, you know.
Yeah. And
not nice.
People kind of giving each other the benefit of the doubt because nobody knew anything at the time, you know.
Right.
And as city rules and, you know, people are, you know, respond to rules coming from up top in a different way. And, some people dig in their heels and.
Yeah, it's good to hear because, you know, I've read articles and heard stories.
You know,
just customers just have no regard or respect, you know, for the other side to some extent.
I mean, if we've learned anything this year, it's to have a little bit of empathy for, you know, your neighbor and whoever you're speaking to. Yeah. And you know,
it should have been done and it's not hard to do it.
Yeah.
So if you have to pivot now, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
So with all that being said, what type of like reboot in your mind are we going to see? Like what you're doing today is you're open.
Mm-hmm.
You got the outdoor space, the indoor space. I don't know how people take to the indoor space, but I'm sure some people eat inside.
Yeah.
Do you think by the end of the year, next year, I mean, are we living through more of the same or do you see a reboot with, you know, substantial changes or you just want to get back to the good of where you were?
You're talking about like an industry-wide reboot or?
Yeah, and you could look in the context or lens of the restaurant or the industry, you know, both.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I came out of quarantine as, you know, as forward looking as I could be was to focus on the things that I could control. And that is, you know, in the immediate restaurant and the livelihood and the well-being of the people who are in that space. And that's what I really can focus on in terms of.
So this isn't a setup or a trap question.
Yeah.
But, you know, just sitting here with you and getting a sense, that's the way you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you sort of handled the business that way anyway, a little mm-hmm. more empathetic, compassionate towards workers, team, you know, all of that. Do you feel that that's even heightened a little? Like, you know, we went through some tough times.
So
Absolutely. So the good of that is at least the environment,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a better feel and all of that.
Yes.
Which is a nice thing. And I think a lot of people, you know, would say that, which, you know, is a good thing.
Yeah.
To the big negatives, there's always some good positives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people will tell you during COVID, everything shut down, but they spent crazy times with their families.
Right.
Their kids, you know, so that's a good
thing. Worked out. Took care of themselves.
You know, the restaurant thing you got to make work out.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking to Eliza Kristen. Eliza is the beverage director at Lilia and Missy. Keep saying it wrong, in Williamsburg, two spectacular restaurants. When we come back, I want to talk to Eliza about some wines, and then I want to talk to you about the wine programs over there and, you know, your thoughts and how you put it together. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth has made specialty cheese in the rolling hills of Wisconsin for more than 30 years. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style Grand Cru cheeses. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sir Choix was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Eliza Kristen. Eliza is the beverage director at Lilia and Missy. Two Italian skewing restaurants.
Yeah.
In that sense. So before we get into the restaurant specifically, hopefully, because as tough as your industry is, there's always the fun part that people think that's the only part, and that's tasting wines and traveling and, you know, even going on. Like, we'll talk about this towards the end of the show, but you're not on Instagram. But if you look at Instagram and you look at people in the industry, they're all over the world.
Oh, yeah.
You know, at wine things, you know. So the travel part, that's a fun part. Has timing allowed you to get back to, you know, a little more of the fun things you did?
Yeah.
You know, to be a wine person and make wines available at the restaurant?
Yeah. I, you know, the tasting appointments that I had last summer and last fall, I'm surprised that I even had them. We had them outside and as safe as we could, and people kept their masks on whenever we could.
Was summer when you first started rebooting that?
Yeah, we reopened Lilia just outdoor, obviously, in July of last year. Yeah. And I mean, it was so interesting hearing the kind of distribution side of what was going on in the wine business and how they were affected. And there were all of these wines that, you know, usually got snapped up by all these restaurants that unfortunately, like, were not open yet or, you know, lost the allocation or all these things. And it was
the dynamic change.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like a flood of things that were available last summer and last fall.
Were you able to take advantage of that?
I mean, I, you know, buy responsibly, and we don't, we weren't in a position to throw
down. Did you
down.
Have to liquidate anything? I mean, did
no.
you guys sell, you know, you heard restaurants brought the seller up to retail or like Del Posto sold everything, you know, stuff like that. You were able to hang in there.
The type of wine lists at both restaurants means that the inventory was very small that we were sitting on.
Yeah. All right. So you're getting back to a little more normalcy with, you know, how you do the wine thing. Tell me, this is what I really want to hear from you. Tell me wine regions, winemakers, wines that are exciting you right now.
Yeah.
And keep it in the context of the restaurant, but go beyond. You know, maybe there are personal things.
Yeah.
There are things that interest you that you know may not work with the restaurant, but you know, you're very compelled to try them or drink them or own them.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we don't work with Spanish wines. We don't work with Portuguese wines. I think those are two areas that I personally don't know enough about because I haven't spent much of my career focusing on. But it seems like everything that I try, and with reps that I taste, you know, wines that are related, they sometimes have a couple things, you know, from those regions.
I agree.
And I end up tasting them and I'm like, oh, I wish I could buy this. Like, I wish it kind of fit into the program. And I would love to deep dive and really
get
into
So in a
that.
Few minutes when we talk about the program,
the
question's going to be, why aren't you putting those wines in
there?
But stay with my first question. So Spanish and Portuguese wines, I'm there. We were in Portugal 2 years ago. I took the whole family. We went to Alentejo, Douro.
Nice.
I mean, spectacular.
Yeah.
You know, and value-driven wines, artisanal, you know, passionate people.
Right.
What else?
At Missy, we're focusing a little bit more on just kind of Mediterranean in general. And
so define, at least in the Missy universe, what are the Mediterranean wines? Is it like a Certico or a Greek? What wine?
So we don't work with Greek wines, but it is still focused on Italy. And my opening list at Missy, there's a champagne list. Again, Italy's still the focus. There was a small Austrian section. Half the menu is vegetables. And, you know, Missy Robbins' whole philosophy behind the way that menu is structured is the way that vegetables can be, you know, entrees and be the star of the show and really to shed some light on them. And, you know, Austrian wines are such a perfect pairing with so many of that.
When we got into that, we might as well get right into it now.
Sure.
Missy is a vegetable-centric restaurant compared to the other one.
It's a two-section menu, vegetables and pasta.
Right.
Yeah.
So how much collaboration is there with you and Missy Robbins as far as food and wine? I mean, obviously, you just answer the question.
Yeah.
You know, Austrian wines complemented the heavy. So the skew at Missy is Mediterranean.
Yes, when I just said Austrian, so it's a little
you sort of disclaimed why, you know, there's Austrian wine.
Yeah.
What else is at Missy?
There's a small champagne list. Missy, before we opened the restaurant, was very excited about the idea of, you know, being able to come in, order a great bottle of champagne, and have a bowl of pasta and enjoy that as a pairing.
Correct me if I'm wrong on this. I would say in the last 5-10 years, mm-hmm. Italian restaurants have added champagne lists that are like through the roof.
Yeah.
When you look at Marta Maialino, you know, some of those people, and then, you know, even other places.
Yeah.
Is there any champagne at Lilia?
Lilia's wine list is 100% Italian.
No champagne. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure, you know, so because of that, no way.
No.
Italian sparklers?
Yes, absolutely.
Lambrusco?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yep. So let's talk about the menu at Lilia.
Sure.
More Italian traditional?
I don't think I would, I mean, I don't want to speak for Missy, but I wouldn't describe her food as Italian traditional. She loves and is inspired by Italian ingredients, and she has spent, you know, her career really mastering pasta. As a category.
See, to me, that's traditional. And I've seen her like in Italy on Instagram with grandmas.
Right. Well,
you know, is this how you make malfadini? You know, I mean, that's somewhat traditional. But I guess her take is she takes it from there.
I'm thinking traditional, like Brooklyn, like red sauce joint type traditional, like the things you would come in and see, expect to
Good
see
point.
On the menu.
Yeah. Good. I wasn't thinking that, but you know, the pasta is made in the traditional way.
There's a creativity, you know, there's a creative aspect to all of them. So the wines with that kind of have to have that aspect as well of interest and story and journey.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you have a philosophy in selecting wines?
Yeah.
Like, is natural wine important? Is it the thing?
Or
because, you know, like Four Horsemen, Frenchette, Justin and Jorge, you know, these guys are like nothing but.
Yeah.
Tell me about your philosophy when you.
I mean, my background and my training was classical. The first wines that blew me away that I can remember are, you know, old Bordeaux's and old Californian reds and, you know, greats of champagnes. And to this day, like
Burgundy wasn't even on the radar then, right?
I mean, it
Not
was,
much.
But again, we're in Champaign, Illinois, and I was you know, at the mercy of the incredible collectors that were sharing their cellars with me.
Right.
So, you know, I don't forget that. And we are in Brooklyn after all, and we're in New York, period. And there is a huge natural wine movement here that you can't and you shouldn't ignore because there are so many fantastic, you know, aspects about it. So I don't know. I would characterize my perspective as a marriage of the two.
Right. Do you small producers?
Yes.
You know, that type of stuff.
Yeah.
You don't need the big names. You need the best names.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I won't even say it. There are certain Napa wines that are so famous.
Yeah.
And they're not necessarily the best.
Yeah.
You know, so having the biggest, best wines is not, you know, usually the most interesting.
Yep.
Which list is larger as far as selection wise?
Lilia's is slightly larger, but they're both very under 100 wines. So they're very small lists.
Do you think it's harder to curate a tight list than managing a bigger list? I ask this to people all the time.
Yeah. I mean, they're different jobs, really. With small lists, there's a lot of trimming. There's only room for so much. And you go through a different process of elimination to determine whether or not you want to put something on the list.
So process of elimination can also involve seasonality, right? Yep. Like, yep. You know, you get rid of certain wines you yep. had. Do you ever get into that funk where there's just stuff you want to put on? That's right.
Yeah.
But you just don't have the room.
I'm lucky that I have two wine lists at my disposal. And if I
and
really
to break away from the categorization of one.
Yes.
You could.
Exactly. Yeah.
But even with the two wine lists, you're talking about two pretty tight lists.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so it's not like you're at like Burns Steakhouse in Tampa or something where there's 9 million bottles or something.
No.
So one of the interesting things I noticed, and we talked about this off air before, mm-hmm. You know, when a lot of people think of Italian wines, they think of like the big Tuscans, super Tuscans, mm-hmm. you know, they think of the big Barolos and all of that. You have some of that, but that's not what, you know, the Italian wine list is about there.
Yeah.
Why? Is it cost? Is it better compatibility with the food? Is it?
It's based on the fact that, I mean, again, my first harvest was in Italy. My first kind of, you know, introduction to the wine world was Baccaro was an Italian restaurant, and the list was also predominantly Italian at the time, and that's where I kind of grew up. And I think that when I am training staff now at Lilia and Missy, who maybe come in that are more familiar with the international varieties.
Yeah, but like, don't Wall Street guys come in and go, 97 Solaya?
I mean, they do. And it's a conversation and it's difficult. And we could technically just give everybody what they want, but I frankly don't have room for it all. And I don't have the room in the budget either.
Are most people amenable to like, listen, we don't have that, but
yeah,
try this, try
that's,
that.
That's my job. And that's my son's job to
right.
you know,
right.
make those tangential sells and get people excited about things that they've never had before. But Italian wine is so, again, like, I think the most challenging thing, but also the most exciting thing about Italian wine is how many indigenous varieties there are to all the regions.
Great
and
country.
It's endless.
It is endless.
It's endless exploration. And, it, you know, we don't do ourselves a favor when we pigeonhole, you know, into Piedmont or into Tuscany or anywhere else.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Do you, this is a sort of a redundant question, but things start changing for the fall? You'll start knocking some stuff out and putting stuff on?
Yeah.
Menu change? I mean, will it become a little heartier?
The menu is, at both restaurants are pretty seasonal. So as things come and go, especially
right.
with the vegetable world, I don't, you know, when I first started at Lilia, I feel like people were crushing. I think we were going through like 15 cases of rosé on the patio. That's changed. People don't drink like that at Lilia and Missy anymore. And there's people, you know, and you're going to ask me this later, but you know, what's my favorite wine? And like, what?
Don't tell me.
But there's something for every moment. And
I know you like Barolo.
It's a cop-out, but
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
All right. I was going to ask you this before. My listeners always love to get, you know, intel from guys like you. Where are the great value wines? Italy certainly offers
so many options.
You know, I mean, for this conversation, we don't even have to, you know, leave Italy. You could do Lambrusco with a pizza.
Yeah.
Vermentino.
Yeah.
Tell me a couple of things that, you know, are worth.
Liguria is always a great region to go to. The whites are wonderful.
What
reds,
grape are they using?
Vermentino, Pigato.
Okay.
You know.
I agree with that.
And Rosese as a red grape is I love. It kind of has it's light. There's a floral quality to it. There's some freshness. There's a little bit of acidity. It's not over the top. It pairs great with so many things.
Yeah.
And Sicily, everyone loves to talk about.
I was just going to ask, you know, about volcanic wines. Do
yeah.
you like those wines?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about, even though Corsica is French?
Yeah.
Does that leave that off the list or?
It doesn't at all. It's on the list at Missy or.
Like Abatucci or any of those guys that are making Canarelli, good Corsica.
Abatucci, all Italian names, by the way.
Okay.
With Sangiovese.
Right. Well, yeah.
Neluccio. Yeah.
Kind of obvious. So those are some good ones.
Yeah.
You know, in the end, I'm going to post your wine list and what we drank and any other recos that you made.
Sure.
I want to do the wine list in a couple of minutes, but are you still studying for certification?
It's kind of been put on the back burner, to be honest, with kind of restaurant operations.
So I get that.
Mm-hmm.
Does something in your head say, okay, when the time comes, we'll get back into it, or you're not even thinking it? So you would like to?
Yeah, I'm always down for continued learning.
Now, we've discussed this vigorously on the Grape Nation, and that is everything that's happened with the Court of Master Sommeliers. I mean, I've had like first, you know, Jane Lopes, people like that.
Yeah.
Do you still want to pursue your Master Sommelier?
I actually haven't been pursuing that for quite a while.
And
I've been working on my diploma with WSET, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
But do you feel like you'd have to do the other one too, or not necessarily?
No. I was kind of taking both exams when I first started out because I wasn't quite sure what path I wanted to go down. And I decided pretty early that I wanted to go down the Wine and Spirits Education Trust path. And,
good for you.
The formatting of information makes more sense to me. The formatting of testing makes more sense to me. It just fit me better.
Right.
Yeah.
So the sway of, you know, a master sommelier, whatever, early on in the decision-making process, it's like, this is the better path for me. You know,
I mean, this
may be a bigger deal, but doesn't work for you. You know, and then they go through all the scandal. So,
yeah. I mean, it's certainly glamorous, and there's a.
Do you think it's necessary now, career wise?
No.
You know, to have that pin? No.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about this early on. A lot of my guests have become winemakers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my favorite's Raj Parr.
Mm-hmm.
He just packed everything in and he's literally walking around a farm. They've become importers, distributors. They wanted to get off the floor. You've worked harvest and your eyes lit up.
Yeah.
Is that an aspiration down the road, or you don't think about that?
You know, that's why I almost didn't come back the first time around. Cause I was like, this is the life that I want. And I realized that I was really young and needed to learn more things and explore more things and kind of hit the ground running and put in the time, put in the work. I think maybe down the road,
if and when.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love restaurants and I don't.
Yeah. So you're not at the point, you know, 50, 60 hours a week, all that. And you've endured COVID. So
if
you can get back on your feet, you still have juice in you to, you know, want to do that.
I do still have juice, yes.
So that's open-ended. That's nice.
Yeah.
All right. One last thing. I don't get this. I don't get why you're not on social media. Just give me a short answer.
So I'm pretty young. I was part of the kind of when Facebook first became pretty widespread in high school. And everyone was on Facebook, and at that point, I had Facebook as well, and I realized then that I didn't want to know that much about other people's lives. I wanted to know. There's kind of a intrusion, not even in my own life, but I don't. It feels like I'm, you know, spying or something, and it feels like I'm, you know, comparing myself to just a picture of someone, like a snapshot of some, literally of someone's life that doesn't provide any kind of context or any kind of conversation. And that's not what I'm interested in.
So that's very cool and very amazing and kind of the opposite. I mean, because obviously my friends, my family, your friends, they're sort of addicted to social media.
Yeah.
I mean, people just stare at their phones all day.
Yeah.
You know, most of that is like Instagram and Facebook. I mean, I know we're all texting and checking in and business and all of that, but, and there's no compulsion. You're at peace.
I totally see the business benefits of being out there because it is such a huge platform that so many people
I found you without social media.
You did. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see it.
I was surprised, but yeah. I was happy. Yeah.
Then when I came across you and started figuring out who is she, it was like anonymous for a while, you know, and I had to kind of dig deep and all. And the more that happened, the more I liked it. So, you know, I got intrigued.
Okay.
So that's where you're at with social media. That's fine.
Yeah.
All right. couple things we want to do before we wrap up. We want to do our wine list. I'm going to ask you five questions. We ask the same five questions to everyone. Be spontaneous. Don't dwell on them. Give me good choices. People literally email me, text me, what was the name of that wine, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's no better people to recommend wines than you and, you know, guys like, you know. Yeah. All right. So what are you drinking now? It could be for work and personal, you know, seasons are changing. What's in the fridge? What's on the bar that maybe is not on the program yet?
Yeah.
You know, what, give me some drinking now things.
So I just put on, or it's been on the Missy list for a second, but Malvasia from Croatia, from Klai is the producer.
Spell.
C-L-A-I.
Klai.
Klai, yeah. It's, you know, Malvasia is pretty aromatic.
Is that the Croatia part that's close to Italy?
Not super close, okay. But yeah, it's salty. It's got like that Malvasia perfume going on. It's kind of checks all the boxes. It's absolutely delicious.
Klai. Yeah. Give me something else.
Let's see. Bruno, if we're talking about Liguria, just for a specific example. Bruno is one of my favorite producers, B-R-U-N-A.
Bruna,
yeah. Their Pigatos are wonderful. Their Vermentino is a pretty new project for them, and it is wonderful. Definitely a leaner style. It's not very ripe. It doesn't have all that fruit that Vermentino sometimes can have, but all that minerality and freshness there.
All right, answer this question for me.
Yeah.
Forget my listeners. I love Lambrusco.
Yeah.
I love turning people onto it with pizza and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a Lambrusco that is good quality, reasonable, and available.
Yeah. I just tasted through the Terra Vive lineup yesterday.
Terra, T-E-R-R-A?
T-E-R-R-E.
E.
V-I-V-E.
Okay.
The 2020s just landed. They are awesome.
And you think like the cool wine shops, they'll be at some of them?
Okay. Rosenthal's the distributor.
Okay. So they're pretty wired in. Yeah. All right. Good job there. Favorite wine and food pairing? You got one? Obviously, you don't eat it every night, every month, but what's that, you know, pairing?
Oh my gosh. I will drink champagne with anything.
Okay. Don't say oysters. You're not allowed to.
No, just anything.
So champagne, does it lean towards like fried foods or potato? You know, is there something? Think for a second. We got champagne. What's that? Okay, now I'm thinking and I'm there with a bowl of potato chips. Love it with it. Can you think of something?
Oh,
I'll take champagne and anything as an answer.
Yeah. Right. I mean, champagne and eggs for brunch. Like, anything like
caviar
that.
Caviar on it.
Not even, just eggs.
That's okay. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I actually, at New Year's Day, I would make scrambled eggs and pour the leftover champagne instead of, like, milk or water.
Yeah.
Gave it a little fluffiness.
Yeah.
All right, third question. You should be able to answer this, although, you know, because of COVID and I know you're busy.
Yeah.
Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Like people that are like, you're more of a restaurant with a great wine program. Mm-hmm. The vibe is great. The people are smart.
Yeah.
Give me places that you go to or know of where the list is great. It's well thought out. The people that work there.
Yeah.
Like Four Horsemen.
I was going to say Four Horsemen.
That checks the box. So like that, you know, go give me something else.
I mean, from my perspective, it's about discovery, right? So if I go somewhere, I want to be able to trust the team and it's a relationship that develops, and that's kind of an old school restaurant
thing. So who
do you
think of, you know, when you...
I honestly don't go out that much. And when I do, I want to go to Four Horsemen.
Okay.
Like, truly. I think they're wonderful.
We're going to put Four Horsemen as the answer.
Yeah.
All right. Fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? The question was initially structured like when I had Aldo Salmon here, like what was the rarest, most expensive wine?
Yeah.
The question has so morphed away from that.
Yeah.
And to what's that wine that was important to you?
Yeah.
It could have been something at Bacara or whatever.
Yeah.
Tell me a favorite all-time wine that, you know, significant, important, had an impact.
So, yeah, the wines that started my career, which are kind of... back to your Aldo Salmon type question.
That's okay, because that's what was there.
Yeah.
You know, it was the Bordeaux and the Cali Cabs. Yeah. But anything, can you remember anything specific? You know, that
late. So two wines that are a little bit in a different categories. Dard and Ribot, Hermitage.
Big fan.
The Hermitage Blanc. It was a 2010.
Blanc.
It was a 2010 vintage. I think I had worked in the restaurant for 6 months. I tasted it and it was like lights out. It was incredible. And then 75, Petrus.
Is 75 a great year for Petrus or not necessarily?
Yeah. Was it? For Right Bank, yeah.
I know like 61, 82, but 75's right in there?
For Right Bank, Bordeaux. Mm-hmm.
Jesus. So the Dard and Ribot is not that crazy expensive. I mean, it's a pretty good value wine. And then you jump right to Petrus. So you balance the seesaw.
I try.
Good for you.
I try.
All right, last question, and you definitely should be able to answer this. Recommend to me best wine around 15, 20, 22 bucks retail.
Okay.
Give me a red, give me a white. You can go category, like I always think Muscadet is a great value. Lambrusco is a cool value. But give me some makers and wines.
Yeah.
Think about that price range.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of...
You mentioned a bunch of them.
Right.
You know, so going back is fine.
I think what I'm pouring in that price range would be kind of a glass pour type wine.
Yeah.
And what I'm pouring right now that is... like completely over delivers is the Le Piane Majorina.
So wait, the maker's La Piane?
L-E-P-I-A-N-E.
And what is it?
So it's, they're in Piedmont, but it's Alto Piemonte, so the north.
Region.
Their kind of flagship wine is the Bocca, but the Majorina is one of their more entry-level wines. It's a Nebbiolo blend with, you know, Vespolina.
And you think if we found a shop around here, it'd be in the 20s?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So that's the red, right?
Mm-hmm.
Give me a white like the. That's a good one. I mean, I'm sure nobody.
Yeah. Ingrid Greiss, Gruner Veltliner.
G-R-E-I-S-S?
G-R-O-I-S-S. Yeah. From Weinvertal.
Not even close.
The Gruners are delicious. Delicious.
That's on the list too.
Mm-hmm. When, at Missy.
Because when you're talking about Austria and whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Those are good ones. Like I said, I'm going to post those.
Sure.
Because you taste a lot of wines to put them on your list. And I think that's what people are looking for.
Yeah.
All right. When we can, and certainly we can, we end the show with a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip. Every week we taste a different wine on air. I asked you if you would bring a wine in. And the criteria was accessible, reasonable, and cool.
Yeah.
And you brought in a wine from the Cortona region of
Italy.
Italy. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to throw it to you.
Sure.
Talk to me vintage, the maker, the grape. Then we're going to taste and evaluate. Hand me that bottle because I'm running out.
Yes. So this is Stefano Amerighi. This is a Pecorino.
Amerighi, A-M-E-R-G-H-I, something like that?
A-M-E-R-I-G-H-I.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
So Cortona is famous for Syrah in Tuscany. His winery is in Cortona, but this is a really special project that is Pecorino from... the Cibollini Mountains, which is the birthplace of Pecorino, the grape. This bottle is probably, you know, 70 bucks on a wine list. So totally reasonable. It's
so, not to give secrets away, retail would be in the 30s or high 20s?
I think, yeah, probably 30s.
Yeah, which is for this interesting of a wine.
Yeah.
And how well it's made. That's a good price point.
So it's... over 100-year-old Pecorino vines.
Wow.
It's Stefano's collaboration with the owner of this particular site, who actually passed away in the earthquakes in 2016. But it's such a small production, and it's his kind of attempt or experiment to make a wine in a little grotto right by the vineyard that's basically a cave, no electricity, no running water. Asked me when, you know, I first opened it, is it a skin contact wine? It's a wine made with zero technology, and that's kind of what that's more about. So it's foot stomped, and then it goes through fermentation all the way dry with the skins and the seeds and all that. And then it gets racked off, put into glass demijohns, and then bottled in the spring. And then it's all about bottle aging. So this is,
this is a 15, right?
Yeah. And I think
is it a benefit to be sitting here drinking a 15 versus
this is incredible.
Like,
yeah.
Like a 19 or a 20.
Just to give you an idea, in 2017, he made 53 bottles of this.
Jesus
Christ. So it's a tiny, tiny production, right. And it's really just a passion project for him.
So this is a special treat for me, and I thank you for that. So let's talk about it. Color is sort of a deep yellow, almost not orange, but moving there, a little cloudy.
Yep.
Right, which is after you just explained how he does it. So that's the color. Here's where I need you. Talk to me about the nose.
Mm-hmm. Pecorino is not a fruity grape. You're not going to get those aromatics jumping out at you.
No.
And to me, it's more, there's like a wooliness, there's a savory quality.
Savory, but not too savory.
Not too, yeah. There's
but definitely.
There's, yeah. Pecorino, I mean, the origins of the grape are cloudy, but there is connection with the kind of sheep herders in the mountain, and therefore we're talking about Pecorino cheese as well. There is a kind of lactic-like cheesiness to this wine, too.
Dumb question.
Yeah.
Is the cheese made in that area, or?
I mean, the sheep graze that area, and all the Pecorinos, you know.
You're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go mouthfeel.
Sure.
So it looks like a pretty, you know, viscous wine.
Mm-hmm.
You throw it over to the tongue, down the throat.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely some
texture
and some acidity.
Yeah.
Like it seems like it'd be a great food wine.
Yes.
I would say medium plus, you know, it's not a thin wine.
No.
It's not a bulky wine in your mouth or whatever. It's got a nice feel.
It's got some broad shoulders on it, but that kind of acidity definitely freshens it up a little bit.
All right, now let's go palate. I want you to tell me, do the descriptors on the palate match the nose?
Absolutely.
What are they?
Again, we're talking about that like
savory herbs.
Lactic kind of cheesy richness. There is an herbaceousness to it. There's a little bit of apple. There's a little bit of fruit there, but it's not driven by that.
A little more sour apple than
there's a little bit of saltiness too.
Oh,
this wine that I get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, effective.
Mm-hmm.
Not the funny thing is when I first smelled it and tasted it, I'm like, this is like Pecorino cheese, and I was too embarrassed. You know, everyone expect, you know, more like me to say, oh, Pecorino,
right.
But it's there.
There's
that lactic thing and all that, which is
for
crazy.
Sure. Yeah.
What ideal foods would you pair with this?
I mean, this is a wine that you hang out with throughout the entirety of a meal. It's not a wine that you start with. It takes some time to open up.
It's not for the veal chop. It's like open it up and just drink it with whatever you're eating type thing.
You're starting with it. You're hanging out with it. It's going to continue to develop. It's been open an hour now before we even really got to the tasting portion.
Yes.
And it's changed a lot.
Yeah, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, for sure.
So not an expensive wine.
Mm-hmm.
Hard to get.
Yes.
Why did you? No, that's okay. There's a story, which is fine.
Yeah.
Why did you pick this wine? Just an inner love for it? It's unique.
I think this kind of passion project is a good example of what I look for the two wine lists. Obviously, the wine list is not made up of, you know, 53 bottle production type wines.
This
is not sustainable.
What kind of bottlings in other vintages?
What do you mean?
Like
quantities? Or
yeah,
like,
quantity, I meant.
Sometimes it's over 100.
But it's super tiny.
Yeah, super tiny.
It's like 8, 10, 12 cases.
Yes.
That's crazy.
And I think New York, in this vintage for the 2015 release, got 24 bottles.
Well, thanks for bringing it in.
Yeah.
Tick the chart off. It's a 2015.
Mm-hmm. 2015 Pecorino from Amarigi.
Noe Vino Bianco.
Yep.
Okay.
Noe is the name of the wine.
Right.
Noah's Ark.
And we love it, and too bad you ain't getting it. all right. Eliza, we got to wrap up the show. I told you now we'd go pretty quickly. I could sit here and still cover a lot of other things. Let me do a quick wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to The Grape Nation on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or, you know, nowadays, wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby, but we use the hashtag The Grape Nation for both. So you can get to the show in any one of those ways. We're trying to build a little community on, what's it called? Clubhouse. So follow us there at BenRuby, although I don't know what's going to be with that. As I mentioned, we'll post Eliza's wine list, all her great answers. I will give you the specifics on the weekly wine sip. If there were other wines, you know, that made sense, you know, to put up, we will do those. One of the questions that I ask my guests at the end of every show is, Eliza, where can we find you on social media? And the answer is nowhere. Which is fine, and she explained why. But if you want more information on Lilia, it's at Lilia New York, right?
At Lilia New York, at Missy New York.
At Missy New York. And if you go on the site, you could see Eliza's, you know, wine list, or, you know, fairly good offering of all of that. Yeah. And certainly to the menu and everything. Eliza, I want to thank you again for being our first guest back in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
You're doing some great stuff out there. It's great to hear, you know, how you got here and what's going on. Thanks to our engineer, Armin, who's back in the saddle in the studio. Thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.